From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, why a group of Rufus King students took their own group photo in response to a picture of teens in Baraboo giving a Nazi salute.
Then an organization taps into the power of what it calls micro-communities to aid athletes with disabilities.
Any disability that you've ever thought of or seen is probably represented by someone within the Achilles community.
Later, Nicolet High School students will perform the world premiere of a challenging concerto.
They are exploring what's sometimes referred to as extended techniques, ways of playing their instruments that have been discovered or explored in the last 50 to 100 years.
And we'll hear an in-studio performance from Milwaukee musician Joe Richter.
Lake Effect is next after the news.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this month, a photo of Wisconsin high schoolers holding their arms in what appears to be a Nazi salute went viral and received international condemnation. The Baraboo students will not be disciplined by the school district because administrators say their actions were protected by the First Amendment.
Staff and students at Milwaukee's Rufus King High School wanted to respond to the Baraboo photo, so they took their own picture. In it, students and teachers are making the American Sign Language symbol for love.
WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke with Rufus King Jr.'s Hannah Olenchek, Kennedy Henderson, and Estella Ramirez. They're all students of English teacher Kelly O'Keefe Betcher, also known as Miss OKB. O'Keefe Betcher organized the photo. She begins by explaining why.
I knew I wanted a picture, but I didn't know how many people were coming. It was a Friday. And Friday afternoons, you know, people are busy and they have a lot. So I invited people, kind of the, you know, if you build it, they'll come. And they did. And I said, I don't want this to be an anti-Baraboo thing. I don't want this to be, oh, they're so terrible, let's turn them into the big baddies. I didn't want that. That wasn't going to be the spirit of it. It's not like any of us are in a position to judge anybody else. But we knew that our students, our Jewish students, our Muslim students, our students of color, that was landing for them, and I wanted to give them an opportunity to respond to it. We knew the format was going to be a picture in some way, but we had some pretty hilarious conversations of what that was going to look like. We wanted it to be embracing. We wanted it to be direct, right? We're not giving Baraboo a pass. There's a real danger in the denial that some adults and community members have said about that. I mean, we spent some time in conversation saying, you cannot tell us that they were waving. You cannot tell us that it wasn't what it was. So let's name it, right? Let's declare the truth of what that picture was. In the same breath, now that there's some truth, where do we go from here? What's the next conversation? Where's the restorative conversation? Where's the healing that hopefully can come from a conversation, but nothing gets reconciled if you're going to pretend that it's something that it's not.
What do you guys think about the fact that the students in this picture are kids your age?
Looking at the picture, not in a like discriminatory way, but everyone is white. They're all male, and coming from a school like King, where we're so diverse, we're so race, religion, gender identity, it's just kind of, Ms. O'Keefe said this at one time, like, we're at an advantage, and sometimes with that advantage, like, we forget that there are parts in this country who have never seen what we come to school every day to look at. Like, they have never had these conversations that we have in this classroom every single day about, like, the hard topics, the topics of what people go through, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. And I think that, like, we don't want to shun them, but we want to bring them in, realizing that they are a part of the state, and kind of go from there and saying, like, how can we fix this? How can we educate you? How can we make people alike realize just what they might not realize, I guess.
Me personally, I couldn't imagine, like, myself or my peers doing anything like that because, like Hannah said, King is a very diverse place. We don't see race, we don't see color, we don't see religion. We just see people who just come to learn. So the fact that they are high school students and that's what they chose to do, the fact that they felt comfortable doing something like that, that drastically changed history, I was disgusted.
Going on, like, knowing that everybody is our age, like, how I feel about that, both the pictures, just comparing them both, like, we're in high school, they're in high school. Knowing that we're putting, like, Rufus King in, not just Rufus King, but looking at my school, it makes me very hopeful knowing that we're putting out people into the world that have this kind of perspective and this kind of knowledge. And, like, knowing that we have so many people who are willing to step up when they need to and willing to provide their voice in situations that are tough, because this is a tough conversation to have.
If you guys could give a message to the Baraboo students and community, what would it be?
Can I start?
Yeah.
Can I start with that one? So just this afternoon, I got a voicemail from a man named Moses in New Jersey. He had seen the picture, and I won't try and do a New Jersey accent, but it was very clear to him that he was moved, and he wanted to buy every single person in the picture an ice cream cone because of how much it meant to his family. So I'm going to assume that he's a Jew, and I'm going to assume that he saw people who might not be Jewish standing up for him. So if I was going to send a message to Baraboo, I would say, I want to stand up for you too, right? I don't know that I have money to buy Baraboo an ice cream cone, but I loved Moses' intention, which was, I saw you doing something right, and we want to celebrate that. And I know Baraboo is on their path, right? I know that they're working to figure it out, and they're grieving, and they're confronting. So my message to Baraboo was, let's learn together, right? We have something really special here, and I bet Baraboo has something really special too. What could we learn together? Maybe have an ice cream cone.
I guess that my message would probably be that there was an issue, and actions have consequences. That's what happens. And I think that the most important thing is to not be like, to not step away from Baraboo and be like, this is who Wisconsin is, and Baraboo is not who we are. Baraboo is a part of Wisconsin, and they always will be. And I guess what we're trying to say is we need to come together as a Wisconsin community, and we need, and I mean, like, not saying that we're the only example, but we create an example for them not to follow, but to learn from. And just to show, like, we're in high school, we're the same age as you, and although you may not have the advantage of having all these different types of people from so many different types of places in your school, and sometimes it's just like that. I mean, like, it's different people live in different areas in Milwaukee and all of Wisconsin, but just more to learn from your mistakes and to recognize them in the first place and to grow from them, I guess you could say.
I would simply say be aware, because whether or not their intention was to generalize hate, it affected a lot of people, like, outside of the Jewish community. So simply be aware of what you do and how you do it.
Do any of you have any experiences that have been brought up by this picture of being discriminated against in some way?
Okay, so me being of African-American descent, of course I have been discriminated against, but I don't want to say I've come to term with it, because I know it's going to happen, because I've gotten looks, stares, you know, bumped, but I love myself. Like, I'm never going to stop being Black, never going to claim anything else but Black. So, I mean, it matters that it's still present in this day and time, but it is what it is. Like, I'm going to be Black. Either you're going to love it or you're going to hate it. I love it.
Anyone else?
Okay, so I'm white, and I'm never going to try to say that I've been racially oppressed. I will never go to that place. But I, coming to school at King, where I'm able to be surrounded by a bunch of people who will talk on behalf of their racial oppression, I'm definitely able to acknowledge my white privilege and see what I can do with it and how I can make change for those who are oppressed. And I think that before coming to King, I didn't have that same like recollection. I went to a primarily white middle school, and I acknowledge that, and that's why I came to King. I live outside a district, and I open enrolled. Obviously, some people don't have the opportunity living in like an all-white neighborhood to just surround themselves with that diverse environment. But I think that just realizing that your all-white setting isn't the norm, isn't realistic, isn't real world, and just where we can go with that and just change, I guess.
Yeah. Does anyone have anything to add to that?
Well, I was just going to say, kind of contrasting with Hannah, being half white, half Mexican, and I mean, I look pretty white. I mean, I've never experienced any oppression towards me based on the way I look, and I'm fortunate for that. But I grew up on the east side of Milwaukee, and in a primarily white neighborhood. But being the youngest of four children, and a daughter to like two amazing parents who want me to experience everything in the world, I went to a bilingual elementary school. I went to La Escuela Fratni in River West, and there I was surrounded with kids who had different first languages than I did. And then for middle school, I went to a school that was 30 minutes away. I went to Wedgwood Park. And there I experienced even more, even different setting, where I was exposed to so many different types of people, and I was in a bilingual program there with primarily Spanish speakers. And then coming here and being in an even larger school, I felt it wasn't like growing up in the Milwaukee public school system. I've definitely been like realized that I'm so fortunate to be able to be surrounded by so many different types of people and to be exposed to different like situations, I guess you could say, or different people who experience different things that I couldn't have experienced if I went to a different school. I'm definitely so grateful to be surrounded with so many different types of people that I don't necessarily relate to, but that I can have knowledge about and learn about.
Do you guys have any other photos planned or any other discussions, events? Ooh, yes. In response to it?
We were just talking about this because I saw that the school district in Baraboo has made a decision not to suspend, and that picture was protected under free speech. And so, yeah, we're going to respond to that. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but we want to say something that your free speech, if it's rooted in hate, is at the expense of someone else's freedom. Mm-hmm. And there's a consequence for that. So watch this space. Something's percolating. We don't know exactly what it is. I'm going to meet with the young people and we'll see. But we're not done with this conversation.
As long as people are going to be doing things like this, oppressing other people, Rufus King is always going to have something to say about it. And it's not like we're trying to do this to like put Baraboo in their place or put these high school kids in their place. We want to bring you up with us, if that makes sense. We want to lift you up because you deserve it. You just need to recognize your issues and move forward.
Okay. I just want to say, our freshman year, because all three of us are juniors, our freshman year, we experienced two passings. Both were seniors, Marisol and Maya. And when the entire school came together for them, it was literally the entire school. Mm-hmm. We all wore red for one passing and yellow for the other. So when King puts their mind to something, and we really feel for something, and we want to do something and make a statement, we're gonna do it. We're gonna do it in huge numbers, and we're gonna do it united.
That was Rufus King student Kennedy Henderson, along with Estella Ramirez, Hannah Olenchek, and English teacher Kelly O'Keefe Betcher. They helped organize a photograph displaying signs for love in response to a viral picture from Baraboo, which shows students from that city making what appears to be the Nazi salute.
Keep listening. We'll meet an athlete who overcame physical challenges by harnessing the power of community. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Training for a marathon is tough enough, but add a physical or cognitive impairment to the mix, and it can require significant additional support. That was a lesson Dick Traum learned after losing his right leg in the aftermath of a serious car accident when he was 24. Nevertheless, he became a pioneer for disabled athletes when he completed the 1976 New York Marathon.
That accomplishment came through many hours Traum spent with his own support system, or micro-community, which included able-bodied and disabled athletes. Traum says without it, he wouldn't even have been able to run around the block.
A few years later, he founded the group Achilles International to help others benefit from micro-communities. It now has chapters in 41 countries. Traum recently co-authored a book called The Courage to Go Forward, which includes the lessons he learned by participating and helping other disabled athletes reach their goals.
For this month's Fit for You, Traum joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about Achilles and the role small supportive communities can play in affecting change.
Well, we started encouraging people with disabilities to run, and at some point, we're doing things that one would consider to be impossible. You know, several double amputees, for example, out there running quality marathons. And we said, what's going on? What's the motivation behind this? And we talked and we thought, and we decided that the concept is really that of the group or the micro community. And that's the key that is making all of these unbelievable achievements successful.
So go into the concept of the micro community. What is it to you?
Well, the micro community to me is really three or four different groups. It's a relationship between a runner and a volunteer. You know, think, for example, of a runner who is blind running with someone holding a tether. It's also a small group where you go out and you have workouts on a Tuesday evening, and maybe there are half a dozen or a dozen people there. And what's happening is that you're running and you're in a sense competing with other people in the group. And then finally, it's the large group or the Achilles group, where we'll have over 200 athletes running in the New York City Marathon. And that community is one that has tremendous impact.
You mentioned that perhaps there's a volunteer leading a blind runner, there's amputee runners. What other groups of people does Achilles serve, both with physical and cognitive limitations?
Well, it's basically the whole range of people with disabilities. So you might be an amputee like myself. You might be a young person who is on the autism spectrum. You might have cerebral palsy. You may have had heart issues, meaning like a heart transplant. You know, anything, cystic fibrosis, multiple sclerosis, any disability that you've ever thought of or seen is probably represented by someone within the Achilles community.
You mentioned that you yourself are an amputee, and I'd like to note to listeners that you were the first amputee runner ever to cross the finish line of the New York City Marathon. So what inspired you to train for and accomplish this feat, and what relationship did you have with running before and after your accident that cost you a leg?
Well, honestly, the reason I was able to do it was because of the group or the micro community. Prior to losing a leg, my sport was wrestling. And if you know wrestlers, they'll tell you that the runs after a workout are really not appreciated. Running was it was seen as a punishment. And so when I started running, it was a totally different sport than what I had known in the past.
You discuss in your book the first quarter-mile loop for someone is such a monumental deal. What was going through your head when you were running and learning how to use your body in a different way?
Well, the great excitement was that I kept on improving, so that I went out there. And I joined a YMCA fitness program. In order to participate, I had to run. In other words, this was the time that aerobics was being introduced, and they didn't want people coming in and doing the sit-ups and the push-ups and then leaving. And the question was, can you run? If you can't run, you can't be part of this program. So I said, sure. And I discovered that I could take a hop and a step, and I could move. I think of yourself as having a leg with a cast on it, a broken leg, and you're trying to cross the street in the green light, you know, and you have to go quickly and you sort of hop and step. And I did that. And over a period of, I guess, about 2 or 3 months, I built up to where I could do like 10 to 12 minutes straight. And this was absolutely fantastic because I was able to do close to a mile without stopping. You know, one leg, I can run almost a mile. I was very, very excited. And then I was getting feedback from the group or the micro community, which had never, ever seen an amputee running. And this encouraged me to continue and eventually to do a 5 mile race.
Well, and then 5 mile to marathon from that base level where you saw running as a punishment. Now so many hours are filled with that.
Yes. The thing that's interesting and it's really a surprise is it's more difficult to get from 0 to 5 miles than it is to get from 5 miles to 26 miles.
Hmm.
You see, by the time I did my first 5 mile race, I was basically in shape. And, you know, again, I had all these friends and support, and I had people who I was almost as fast as, and I would see myself improving, and I had all of this positive energy motivating me to do more.
Now, when did you execute the concept of guide runners? You mentioned you had friends helping, but when did you see the potential of having set volunteers able to help lead people with an Achilles during these races?
Well, you know, right from the beginning, so that when I went out and did the marathon, in fact, when I did shorter races, I would have somebody with me. And what that person might do is, you know, pour water over my head if it was hot, encourage me, you know, to walk up a hill, give me some encouraging thoughts. I remember one time it was particularly brutal, and my volunteer coach said, "Dick, you know, the next mile is downhill, and we think of this part of the course as the Haagen-Dazs, period." You know, because it's smooth and it's cool. And, you know, it's wonderful to have someone there who is encouraging and supporting you.
And as people who perhaps are not familiar with Achilles see people such as yourself, amputees, anyone running with a partner in Achilles, the runners themselves are getting seen in a different light by the public, but are they also seeing themselves differently, redefining themselves, seeing their disabilities in a different light?
Yes, it's very, very true. Virtually everyone has a disability. It may be a physical disability, but it might also be one of, gee, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I'm running, I'm tired. But gee, here's someone with one leg who is running, and that person can do it, I can do it. You know, I talk about a friend who was running a race up Mount Washington, and the first 2 miles were flat. And these two people passed him and patted him on the back and said, you know, congratulations, beautiful, God bless you. So as he's going up Mount Washington, an amputee is relatively faster and his able-bodied peers going uphill. So he manages mile 3 and mile 4 to pass these people, and he comes up behind him, he taps him on the back. He wanted to say, God bless you, too, but he didn't have the nerve.
Well, and with the importance of uplifting people, either through realizing the willpower they have to harness in themselves or through the group, you've always had and valued the importance of working to help others. So how have you honed this passion of yours to translate to the unique partnerships you help to facilitate through Achilles, through Cigna, through the people within these communities?
Well, what happens is that you literally move from being the child, like when you're running in a race, in effect, you're the child. And when you move from being the child to helping somebody else, you become, in effect, a parent. And people, including myself, get more joy out of helping others than they do achieving themselves. And it's a very, very important concept that is just now becoming more visible.
Yeah, your book, you mentioned that both you and your co-author, David Cordani, have a, quote, bleeding heart optimism shared between you both. And with this optimism, you know, I imagine you need that to go beyond the willpower that your members possess. And I'm curious, with any strategy, any training of running a race for anybody, you need a plan of action. And with your plan of action for Achilles, you are with members, you know, from the hospital bed forward, you know, when they're not even thinking about perhaps walking down the hallway. They're saying, you can do this, you can run a marathon. So why was that important for you to have your members in potential new members' lives right away after, you know, a massive life or health moment has happened to them?
Well, you know, from my perspective, we're, you know, it's sort of like a Horatio Alger story. And what we're doing is we're encouraging these folks to become Horatio Algers. A lot of the soldiers went into the armed services because, you know, they were jocks, they were good athletes, and their big thing was sports, and all of a sudden that was taken away, theoretically. And what we do is we come in and we say, no, it's not really taken away. Join us, become a marathoner, and we turn to mainstream sports. And, you know, it's sort of like, oh, my goodness gracious, I wonder if that's possible. What we're doing is we're planting seeds, and we're also giving people an opportunity to achieve. And I think that one of the greatest joys in the world is that of being able to achieve.
Right. That you mentioned the power of, quote, what's next. So when someone achieves anything from a 5K to a half to a full marathon, how do you feel when you see your members accomplishing their first major goal and then being fed with that optimism that you founded this company with, being fed with, you know, new passion, new resilience to be able to do what's next?
It's the spirit of life. I think of Tammy Duckworth. Tammy is a double amputee. She lost her legs in a helicopter, was shot down, and she came out and she started working out with us, and she achieved the marathon, and then she eventually became a congresswoman in Chicago, and she's currently, you know, U.S. Senator. And what she did is she continued to achieve. And I feel that we may have encouraged her a bit by giving her that spark of achievement.
Right. And what do you think the strength of having a simple mission that can be expanded upon easily, you know, how do you think this has benefited you to expand not just in the United States, but around the world?
Well, when we expanded internationally, I discovered it was very, very easy because we're taking a concept that people internationally had never, ever thought of. And it's sort of like, oh, my goodness gracious, isn't this wonderful? And I used to talk about the situation where it was easier for us to set up a chapter in Bangkok than it was to set up a chapter in Brooklyn. In other words, it was a different, it was very, very special and unique. And we just have been very, very successful in terms of our international chapters.
Yeah, what kind of strengths do you think these small mobilized groups have to tackle pressing issues both personally and individually with their members and other wide pressing issues?
Well, I think that what's happening is that we, if you think of a disabled people as a community, we're basically following successes that have occurred with females, with minority group members, in that we're coming back and we're becoming part of mainstream life.
What do you like people of all ages, all abilities, to think about when reading these stories, and what do you want the call to action to be once they close the last page of this book?
I think that the body English is, gee, if these people can do this, I can do something that I didn't think was possible. I'll tell you a story. Going back many years ago, after I lost my leg, I saw a psychologist, and the psychologist was saying, look, Dick, you know, you lost your leg, was really not that big a thing, and there's virtually nothing that you can't do because you lost your leg. And I said, that's ridiculous. There are things I can't do. And he said, well, go ahead, name one, and I'll show you how. It's not correct. So I said, well, I'll never beat Frank Shorter at the marathon. Okay, some years later, this is 1977, I'm running the second New York City Marathon, my second, and Frank Shorter is running it. and he dropped out at 16 mile. So I beat him in the marathon. With power to do the impossible.
Yes. Well, Dick, I really enjoyed the book authored by yourself and your partner, David Cordani, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share your valuable lessons with us.
And thank you for a great interview.
Dick Traum is the founder of Achilles International and the co-author with David Cordani of The Courage to Go Forward, The Power of Micro-Communities. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for our latest Fit for You segment. You can find more information about his work and hear past segments at WUWM.com.
Another quick break now, and then why two generations of Nicolay High School alums are working in concert with the school's current orchestra. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Current Nicolay High School students are getting a musical education from those who came before them. This week, 2004 alumna violinist Hannah Hurwitz came back to the school to be part of the music department's Artist in Residence program.
She's mentoring the school orchestra in preparation for tonight's world premiere of a new modern concerto called The Little Bird. It's composed by another alum, assistant professor of composition at the University of New Orleans, Yotam Haber.
Haber explains to Lake Effect's Mayon Silver why it's so cool that high school students at his alma mater are now playing modern classical compositions.
When I was in high school, I didn't even know that composers still existed. I thought they were a breed that had died in the 19th century. And so I was exposed to contemporary music through an art teacher at Nicolay High School, and started realizing that, yes, living composers did exist and that that was something I really wanted to do. I mean, I think that when kids study art appreciation, we consider that a pretty normal pursuit. And yet studying new music appreciation isn't really heard of. I think that it enriches us, makes us better people, no matter what field we later go into.
That is interesting to have an art teacher expose you to music in Nicolay.
Yeah, it really was. It was a special influence for me. He was an art teacher who was really, really into contemporary music and would just loan me CDs from his collection. It just really blew my mind.
And you'd say that that was the beginning, the nutshell of you getting into contemporary compositions?
I was convinced that I needed to be a composer from a young age, around 10 or so, when I my parents bought me a cassette that had The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky on one side of it and Benjamin Britten's A Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra on the other side of the tape. And I would listen to them incessantly and thought, I can do that.
That is cool. With this new composition, this Little Bird composition, what is it like having high school students play it? I mean, what are the special criteria for, I mean, did you think about them in mind that
Absolutely.
You were going back to Nicolay?
Absolutely. I thought a lot about how to create a piece. It's a concerto, actually. It's a Little Bird concerto. It's a little violin concerto written for an alumna of Nicolay, Hannah Hurwitz, who's come back to work with the students as well. And I have known Hannah for several years. She is one of the best violinists around, and she also specializes in contemporary music. So I knew that I could throw her anything, and she'd be able to do it. And at the same time, I wanted to do something that would be fun and challenging for high school musicians without dumbing down the music in any way, without making it feel like music for kids. I wanted to write a serious piece of music because I take them very seriously. And yet, I didn't want to overwhelm them. So it was a real balancing act of how much can I give them and yet letting them succeed. I don't want them to fail, of course. So they've been working very hard this semester preparing, and I came to listen for the first time this week. I came from New Orleans, and I was really amazed at how much they've accomplished. They are really entering my sound world, a very alien sound world, I think, to most of the students. And they're doing it with great, great enthusiasm and seriousness. They understand that every single one of their parts is important. It's a concerto for a small orchestra and violin and harp, and yet I don't treat the members of the orchestra like one big monolithic group. Violins, cellos, violas. Instead, every violin has their own separate job. Every cello has their own separate job. So they feel, I think, empowered that their part really matters and they need to step up to play it because they matter. They can't just be wallflowers in this piece.
What are some of the responses that you're getting from the students, like when you went and listened? What did they tell you about it afterwards?
Well, a few students actually thanked me for coming and for writing this piece. And, you know, it's not that much talking, but it's a lot of, I saw the reaction while playing, how deeply they were engaged with the piece, that it was a serious business for them. And I remember when I was at Nicolet, a composer had come to work with us, had written a piece. And I remember that feeling of just pure joy that someone had written something for us. That was exciting.
So Little Bird, tell me about the germination of this concerto, and also what are some of the soundscapes that the students are exploring into?
Well, the name comes from a lullaby, a Yiddish lullaby called Schlaf mein Vögele, which means sleep, my little bird. And it's a lullaby that my wife and I have been singing to our little daughters since they were born. It's a tune that's kind of ingrained in our heads. And so this piece is dedicated to our little girls and to my wife. And the piece itself is this very intimate, little, quiet lullaby, in effect. And the orchestra envelops the soloist with, I would say, night sounds of the night. And they are exploring what sometimes referred to as extended techniques, ways of playing their instruments that have been discovered or explored in the last 50 to 100 years, very different from the way that, say, Tchaikovsky used the string instrument, new ways of producing sounds. And as I started to write it, Jamin Hoffman, the conductor, asked me, would you write it not just for string orchestra, but also include harp? And as I began writing it, I realized that the harp part was integral, and it sort of morphed from being a little violin concerto to being a concerto for harp and violin. And the harp is constantly in dialogue with the violinist to produce almost like a meta instrument, an instrument that's morphed from the violin and the harp together. They're almost always playing as if they were fused to each other.
So speaking of the harp, we'll listen to a clip from a harp student at Nicolet. Her name is Callie Green. She's first playing her harp traditionally, and then she demonstrates some of the ways you asked her to play the instrument, like, for example, using a honey stir between the strings. Here she is.
I have honey stirrers here. What he has me doing in the beginning part of the piece is to put them in between my strings, like that, and then pull it, make that noise, And also we have this, which is a super ball. So I do a couple things with it. I can rub it on my soundboard. I'll make that really loud sound. And then also I can rub it on my string, so. It's very dramatic.
They're such fun sounds. Did you engage with the harpist at all when you went to meet with the students?
Absolutely. And the harp is, for me, a deeply mysterious and gorgeous instrument. And as I was writing the harp part, I worked closely with one of the great harp players in Louisiana to make sure that everything was feasible, doable, and there was some back and forth even with the harp player here at Nicolet High School, just to make sure that things work. I as you heard in that clip, I use some strange devices that normally aren't associated with a harp. I ask the harp player to find wooden honeycomb stirrers, honey stirrers, and stick them into the strings of the instrument and pull on them, creating this crazy twanging sound. And I asked her to use a super ball, which is a kind of a rubber bouncy ball, which she rubs along the body of the harp. So those are techniques that aren't heard that often in the harp. So
it must be kind of fun for them to do that, you know?
I think so.
Yeah. And in coming up with these compositions and these new ways of playing instruments, is it kind of improvisation on your end? Like you're trying out different sounds, you know, there's kind of an influence of jazz almost in your compositions?
I would say that a composer doesn't exist in a vacuum. Wherever a composer happens to be influences that composer, whether they like it or not. The fact that I now am based in Louisiana, New Orleans, the birthplace of jazz, I'm sure has an effect on me. The piece does not leave a lot of room for improvisation. The students really are doing what I want them to do. However, you're right in saying that I think the act of composition involves an element of play. You go into your studio and you just play and figure things out and try things out and go forwards and go backwards and erase and create. And that element, there is an element of improvisation. It's sort of like writing a book or a story, I imagine, where you edit. Editing becomes a large part of writing music.
Now that you're having a world premiere of The Little Bird, if it's warmly received, will there be a world tour?
I hope so. I would like to say that it is no small thing that Nicolet commissioned this work and shows a great, great commitment to contemporary music, something that we barely see in schools with not contemporary, just regular old music. We see so few programs. The fact that Nicolet is not only committed to music but to bringing contemporary music to light is incredible, is totally amazing. And of course, I hope that this piece has a life now, begins, that this is just the beginning of the work, but I am totally overjoyed that my alma mater has made this piece happen.
Yotam Haber is a composer, assistant professor of composition at the University of New Orleans, and a 1994 alum of Nicolet High School. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver.
There is a world premiere of his composition, Little Bird, by 2004 Nicolet alum, violinist Hannah Hurwitz, and the Nicolet Orchestra at the high school at 7 p.m. tonight.
One last break, and then we'll revisit our conversation with Milwaukee musician Joe Richter ahead of a show tomorrow evening at the Colectivo Back Room. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
There's a heart that needs love, 'cause it's been broken apart. It's a love that couldn't last it all forever, but she just wasn't strong enough. She said, baby, I don't love you anymore. That's the last I saw her walking out that door. But then it was over, just like that. Just let the tears come running down.
Milwaukee musician Joe Richter's early work includes time with some area cover bands and his own acoustic albums. But his latest release, Revival, is his first produced album with a full band behind him.
We sat down with Richter in the performance studio ahead of his appearance at Summerfest this year, but with a full band show tomorrow night at Colectivo Backroom, we're revisiting some of that conversation. He talked about what he was trying to express with the album.
From the time that I started actually writing music to now, and how my music has grown over the years, and not just my music, but me as a person, and the things that I've been through in life, and how I've overcome adversity, and how I have, become a better musician over the years. And so I decided to title it Revival, because initially we were going to have a gospel revival on the record, which would have been super awesome. And I'm still thinking that's going to be a goal for my next record. But so I'm thinking gospel revival. And then I think about revival and what it means, you know, and that's, I decided to title it Revival. So, yeah, that in a nutshell.
And as for, you mentioned what the record is, mm-hmm. did you go into that saying, here's my goal of this new record, this is what I want in it? And what do you feel that was missing in your music before then that you wanted to accomplish?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just, what was really important to me was having the right musicians. You know, I had a vision, and I've always, any song that I write, I picture a band. I knew that from the get-go. So I had to reveal that vision to the musicians as to what I wanted, and they executed it wonderfully.
What's your first memory of music that first sparked your interest in performing yourself?
Wow. Well, for some reason, when I was a kid, I had a fascination with Elvis, and I don't know why, but I was a big fan of his music, mostly his voice. So I guess it was just recalling when I was younger, just being a big fan of Elvis and hearing his music, and then of course following that, you know, I discovered Billy Joel, and that's kind of when everything. That's when I really decided that I wanted to do music.
Was there ever, a family member or anyone that introduced you, or was it just kind of self-exposure to things Billy Joel?
Yeah, I mean, my aunt took me to tons of concerts when I was a kid, so I'm very grateful for that. So she took me, this is probably before 10 years old, I went and saw Rod Stewart at the Marcus Amphitheater. We went and saw Billy Joel, we saw Springsteen. She introduced me to a lot, like Jackson Browne and Van Morrison, so it was a lot of the singer-songwriters before my time that really inspired me. So, yeah, she was a pretty big influence in my music career. So,
when did you decide to start learning an instrument? Did you learn guitar first?
I learned piano as well. Yeah, I learned piano first. I probably started when I was about 8, and believe it or not, the piano I started, and I was about maybe 41 keys. My brother actually got it for Christmas one year. I was extremely jealous. And so he got that, but he never played it, you know? So I'm like, let me just, you know, wipe the dust off this thing and start playing it. And there's a little chord book that came with it. And I remember seeing John Cougar Mellencamp, Pink Houses. Okay. So I started doodling that song and learning chords, because I think that song is like G and C pretty much. So I started learning that, and from there, you know, it just took off.
Right. You're kind of a blend of Americana, folk pop, rock with your songwriting. Does the lyric lend itself to you or the musical style first?
The musical style, always. That's how it is for me. And I never write a lyric before I write a melody. I always write a melody first. And then comes a lyric, because I believe that sometimes you don't even need a lyric, you know? Sometimes the song will just take you where it wants to go. And then, you know, the listener can just decide what they want it to be about, you know? But the music guides me. It guides me where I want the song to go and what I want the song to be about. And then I think about it and I say, yeah, just like Happy Tears, you know? I mean, the music came before the lyric in that. So it's just a happy, happy little melody, as my Bob Ross.
Yeah, said. I was just thinking.
Happy, happy little melody.
I had a nice little chord over here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the happiest man in this world. Ain't nobody gonna tell me otherwise, no. And a man like me has gotta be so glad to have what he has that he's never had. I got love with the woman, I got a child. He ain't a human, but he's everything a dad's ever wanted. I got happy tears down my face running. I got love, I got so many. And I got everything more than just a penny. I got happy tears down my face running. I got everything a man's ever wanted. I got love.
Joe Richter's latest album is called Revival. He takes us out with a performance of the song he was just talking about called Happy Tears. He'll play a show tomorrow evening at the Colectivo Back Room, and you'll find a link to his full interview with Audrey Nowakowski and performance that aired in June at WUWM.com. And that's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next. That I do.
Yeah, and he's smiling, he's looking down. Then he's bobbing his head to this beautiful sound. He's wondering where I've been all along. Giving me the words to this song. I got love, I got so much.